You're listening to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Let's talk AI and bioweapons. Some local scientists are now warning that bad actors could use AI to create the next pandemic faster and more affordably than we might have imagined. Boston Globe tech writer Hiawatha Bray told us earlier this week about a professor who uncovered the risk while teaching students at MIT.
Well, incredible as it might seem, he had students who weren't all scientists. This was in the MIT Media Lab. He didn't tell me what these guys were all majoring in. People forget MIT is like political science and art majors, too. But in any case, these were not biologists. He, by the way, is a biochemist, but he teaches in the Media Lab. And he decided to see, as an exercise, could you use conversational AI, the kind that you can talk to and get answers from, could you use that to find out how to make a deadly pathogen if you didn't already know how? And he had the students form three groups of like three or four students each, and to use all the common popular AIs we know about, like Bing and Google Bard and GPT-3 and all the other ones. And they started asking questions that they carefully tailored to try to get the answers they wanted. And within an hour, they had compiled a roadmap explaining to them how to create a deadly pathogen by getting the resources they would need to do DNA synthesis so that they could mass produce it. And they figured out how to do it.
Now, the roadmap thing is part of what's really striking here, because it wasn't just, yes, you can get one and there are these kinds of pathogens and here's the DNA signature. This was, and you could get this component part from this company and this, and there was even some deviousness. You could hide what you were trying to do to get around laws and regulations,
they even explained that, you see, one of the things that they do, there actually are people thinking about this. And there are, for example, there's a database, I believe it's called BLAST, which is used by scientists to check the gene sequences they're working on against a listing of known pathogens. And you're supposed to check anybody coming in to order, I'd like this DNA sequence made up for me, please. And you're supposed to check to see if it's one of those known pathogens. But they explain how you could possibly tweak your pathogen in a few ways to hide its true intentions and still get the DNA sequence you need to build it.
Okay, so a couple of weeks ago, Hiawatha, I'm on vacation, and we rented this house, and they had a whole shelf of books. And I pull out some giant book, right? And it's an old spy novel.
Ah.
And in the old spy novel, the bad guys, and I won't say which country they're from, but the bad guys carefully piece together orders from all over the world for all the pieces they need to put together a nuclear program. Mm-hmm. And this is considered like spy fiction.
Yeah.
But you're saying that in less than an hour, a non-sovereign nation, right, just a person, would be able to piece together what they needed to have a playbook for releasing a deadly pathogen,
Creating, not releasing, a deadly pathogen. Right. Creating it, not necessarily releasing
it. Okay, is that because they didn't ask the releasing questions?
Yeah, they never asked. But, yeah, well, no, I don't even think this is in the same universe as nuclear weapons. No, I mean, come on. People don't seem to understand. Building an atomic bomb is relatively easy if you have the fissionable material. We had to build an entire city in Tennessee to make the fissionable material. That's the hard part. You need to be a country to come up with the kind of money to build an atomic bomb.
But in this case, the average person.
Exactly. All these pathogens are, well, you're still going to need a fair amount of resources, but we're talking millions of dollars instead of billions of dollars. And so pretty much any country or any evil genius or maybe Blofeld running Spectre or somebody could put together the resources to do something like that. And people have worried about this for years. That's why BLAST exists, this database that they can use to see if somebody might be working on something that's dangerous. But the AI is helping figure out how to get around all that. And look, I don't want to make this sound like we're on the verge of all these people in their basements designing these killer plagues with the help of AI. There's still a lot of work you have to do in order to do this. The point that they were trying to uncover by doing this experiment is that today's AI do not have, if you will, the ethical limitations built into them to stop them from doing something like this.
So there are two pieces there, Hiawatha, and I want to do both of them. One is this ethical limitations part, and the other, and I'm going to flag it so we'll be able to pick up on it. And, and by the way, the MIT professor who co-authored this paper and who you spoke with was a guy named Kevin Esvelt. The other part was the inputs, right? The biologists, the scholarly papers, et cetera, that shared all the kind of information about past pathogens that would make it possible to know these things.
That is a very good point, because he talks about this. He says this is not just about AI. He is very concerned that scientists share too much information about some of their research. And he thinks that there are scientists out there in the world who are going to publish stuff that will give people the roadmap. See, one of the things that happened in this experiment was the AI actually chose potential candidates, actually chose pathogens that might be worth looking at as ways to create a new pandemic. But the ones that it chose are the ones it knows about. And Professor Esveld said, basically, I don't think they're virulent enough. If you turn them loose, they could do a lot of harm, but they wouldn't be like a total pandemic.
For example, the 1918
right,
flu.
Right. One of the things it said was, here's what you could do with the 1918 flu virus. But the thing is, that is still relatively close to the flu viruses we have today. And so we've already got enough natural immunity so that even if they built something like that, it wouldn't just sweep through the world and kill millions of people the way it did back in 1918.
Yeah, still deadly, but right. We have the ability to keep it from reaching pandemic levels.
What Dr. Esveld is worried about is that people keep publishing their research on other potential pathogens that could be a heck of a lot more dangerous. And that's what he thinks. One of the things that has to happen is much greater caution on the part of scientists about publicizing this kind of know-how. And, you know, it kind of sort of goes against the traditions of scientific research. But of course, there have always been limits, scientific ethics on scientific research, things that scientists have agreed not to do, like the classic example is human cloning, where voluntarily, and it's actually worked, scientists around the world who worked in that field just said, we're just not going to do it. We're just not going to do it. And it's held so far. So something like that could be arranged, and hopefully it will be.
So I want to play you a little bit of sound from a conversation that we had with Massachusetts Senator Ed Markey, which we've just aired. And he was actually talking about big tobacco. He had been telling us a story about how his own father's experience had had him take on big tobacco. But there's a piece in the middle. You'll hear it. You'll know it when you hear it.
Big tobacco told a big lie about their product. Big climate, oil, gas, coal. They tell the big lie, notwithstanding the impacts on families. And by the way, the same thing is going to happen on AI. Oh, don't worry about it. You don't want the tightest possible controls over it, because you will miss its potential even as it harms people with no protections, no ethical guidelines that are built around it.
So, you know, just the last few days, we hear this from Massachusetts Senator Ed Markey. Do you believe, based on what you've studied in terms of other kinds of internet governance, other types of technology governance, regulations, et cetera, Hiawatha Bray, that we have the capacity in the private sector and or the public sector to create the kinds of regulations or ethical frameworks and enforce them in time that might be required here?
I honestly don't know. When you're in a situation where the people who actually develop the technologies are themselves saying, we don't know how we're going to control this yet. You had this organization, OpenAI, set aside this new foundation that they've set up that are going to give grants to teams of people to try to, what these people are trying to do is to figure out the basic principles that will be needed to regulate AI. Because right now, we're not even sure exactly what you would do to regulate it. You just gave a great example where how can we regulate it by, say, not training it to do dangerous things? Because what is a dangerous thing? When you train it to do something that was originally intended to be beneficial, and then you find out, hey, we could use this AI to invent a new nerve gas, what are you going to do? Not teach AIs about chemicals and chemical engineering? It's going to be a problem. You can't not teach them some of these huge fields of knowledge without enabling them on some level to do bad things. I don't think anyone has answered those questions yet. And we're still, and that even leaves aside the more mundane issues that I think we've talked about in the past. People are using AI-assisted products nowadays for all kinds of things that affect people's lives now, like whether or not you're going to get bail if you've been arrested. There are AI programs that try to help decide that, whether or not you're going to get a mortgage, things like that.
So let's listen to another piece of sound, actually, from Senator Ed Markey, who brought up something similar here.
Even today, the big tech companies are engaging in algorithmic discrimination against Black and brown individuals in America, but it's online. So, we're not going to be interviewing you for a job. Oh, we're not going to allow you to go through that house, but they can use the algorithms to make sure you don't even know about it, about these opportunities.
To your point,
absolutely,
Hiawatha.
Absolutely. There are all kinds of things that could happen. I mean, there are now computers that can judge. I mean, I think I mentioned this to you. Maybe I didn't talk to you about it. There are computers that are AI programs that can look at your social media posts and even your picture and figure out your political leanings with a remarkably high degree of accuracy. It can actually say, I see that person. He's probably a liberal. He's probably a conservative. Now, imagine that's connected to a program that's being used to help decide whether or not somebody gets a job. Oh, I'm not going to hire that guy. He's right-winger, or he's a left-winger, or something like that. I don't know that people are doing that, but in principle, they could. And there's evidence that there's already stuff like this happening with, you know, welfare benefits,
jobs,
loans,
race,
things like that.
Yeah.
And that's on a very basic level compared to what we've been talking about before, and we haven't figured out how to handle that yet.
So it brings up three things, Hiawatha, and I feel like, you know, as I've been learning from you about AI as we've gone on in these conversations over time, three mm-hmm. chunks of things, right?
Right.
One is the behavior and the governance of the behavior of AI.
Right.
Two is the behavior of people using the AI. And then three is the data that the AI consumes in order to develop its algorithms, learn, quote unquote, and then take the next step. So, you know, I'm thinking of the argument that Elon Musk, who owns Twitter, is making that the reason to limit the number of tweets that a user might see is in part to avoid AI being able to scrape Twitter data and use it, you know, to feed its stores, at least without paying for it.
Yeah, absolutely.
So
and right there is a huge controversy in itself. These AI companies are out there scraping all this information, and often it's information about individual people or about businesses or about works of art or about books or whatever. Shouldn't they have to pay something for that? Why are they using all that stuff free of charge? But that's a tiny question compared to some of this other stuff that's floating around. By the way, in the case of Elon Musk, maybe he wouldn't have as much of a problem if he hadn't fired everybody. Some of those people, because, you know, this is happening to other social networks as well, and they're not doing something like this, which suggests that they are finding ways to identify these bots and throttle the scraping without making everybody else totally confused.
So, Hiawatha, what is a first step that the humans in this mix can take that you think has promise? Or something you're seeing here in the Commonwealth that you think has promise?
I'm honestly, you know, not sure what we need to be doing, except I think we've got to retreat from using AI for anything that is likely to have a direct effect on human beings' lives unless we know exactly what they're doing and why. I mean, that one seems like a no-brainer. There are cases of AI that are harmless, you know, where you're using AI. Like, for years, companies like IBM have been using machine learning to figure out what looking at a city to figure out what the traffic patterns are, and they can use that data to change the timing on traffic lights, reroute the bus routes, etc. See where people really go as opposed to where people think they go. Now, that's a case where AI, you know, it doesn't really matter. It's not going to hurt if you'll use AI for something like that. It's not going to change an individual's life. But stuff which could change somebody's life, AI should not be used to do something like that until we are absolutely sure we understand what it's doing and why it's doing it. And I think that's something we could be doing as a start. But that doesn't begin to answer some of the questions we've addressed here. Like, what can you teach an AI to do that it won't learn to misuse in some way? Because we don't know how this data could be misused until an AI or a human think of it. And then they go, oh, I know. And the next thing you know, you've got people creating pathogens and nerve gas.
Boy, the positive and the negative side of the
Absolutely.
Human imagination. Mm-hmm. Hiawatha Bray, Boston Globe technology writer. Always great to have you. Thanks so much.
Oh, glad to be here.
Hiawatha joined us in studio 2 earlier this week.